Picture a young girl in Tehran, sitting cross-legged on her bedroom floor as her father reads aloud from ancient Persian epics and French novellas. These weren't just bedtime stories, they were survival kits. In a country sliding toward revolution, where certainty would soon replace nuance and ideology would trump imagination, these tales became something more precious than any physical refuge. They became a portable homeland, one that could never be confiscated at a checkpoint or burned in a public square. This is what literature does in its most radical form. It gives us a place to stand when the ground beneath our feet turns hostile. In our current moment, when both Iran's theocracy and America's polarization threaten to reduce human complexity to binary choices, we need this refuge more than ever. Reading dangerously means engaging with opposition, discovering ourselves by knowing our enemies, and resisting the tyrant within us before we can effectively fight the tyrant outside. This is what literature does in its most radical form. It gives us a place to stand when the ground beneath our feet turns hostile. Fahrenheit 451 opens with firemen burning books while citizens cheer from their living rooms. Bradbury's dystopia isn't about forced compliance. It's about voluntary surrender to wall-sized televisions over genuine thought. Like Plato's cave dwellers mistaking shadows for reality, today's algorithms curate our world through social media echo chambers. Totalitarianism thrives on simple binaries because complexity requires effort. Books threaten the system by refusing borders and asking more questions than they answer. Montag transforms after meeting Clarisse, who reintroduces forgotten sensory experiences, Rain's taste, conversation's pleasure. His wife Mildred exemplifies spiritual death, addicted to parlor games that substitute hollow interaction for genuine connection. The novel concludes with exiled book lovers memorizing entire texts to preserve humanity's literary heritage after nuclear war. These rebels plan to build a mirror factory for societal reflection. Political power may topple monuments, but cannot silence poetry's voice. Zora Neale Hurston embodied defiance. No, I don't weep at the world. I am too busy sharpening my oyster knife. Despite facing oppression as an African-American woman with intellectual ambitions in the early 20th century, she remained feisty and spirited. Her work contrasts sharply with Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye, featuring Pecola Breedlove, a young black girl who believes herself hideously ugly and dreams of having blue eyes. These characters represent opposite responses to oppression. One, refusing to accept the system's power over her self-definition, the other, destroyed by internalizing society's brutal judgments. Pecola's tragedy lies in absorbing white beauty standards completely, descending into madness while believing her wish for blue eyes granted. Hurston's Janie Mae Crawford searches for love and fulfillment rather than acceptance, defying convention by falling for Tea Cake Woods, a poor man 12 years her junior. Hurston faced criticism for supposedly ignoring racial politics, but she wrote about individuals, blacks without whites constantly hovering above them. Instead of presenting African Americans as generalized victims, she rescues them from stereotypes, restoring dignity stolen by slavery and racism. Both authors demonstrate different forms of resistance. Morrison revealing Pecola's inner beauty through poetic language, Hurston creating a character who refuses society's limitations. The lesson resonates beyond race. Self-definition becomes the ultimate act of resistance. Israeli novelist David Grossman's To the End of the Land follows Ora, whose son Ofer has gone to war. She believes that by being absent when news arrives, she can magically prevent his death. While writing this novel, Grossman's own son Uri, a tank commander, was killed by a missile just 2 days before a ceasefire. Like Sherazade, Ora uses stories to survive, telling tales to Avram, her friend, former lover, and Ofer's biological father during their walk across Galilee. What makes Grossman's work remarkable is his refusal to shield himself from the legitimacy and suffering of my enemy, nor do I shelter myself from the surprising similarities I discover between him and me. American writer Elliot Ackerman, a former Marine who served five tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, shares this approach. His memoir, Places and Names, describes meeting Abu Hassar, a former Al-Qaeda fighter in a Turkish refugee camp. Unable to speak each other's language, they communicate by drawing a map together, marking where they fought. Our hands now chase each other's around the map, mimicking the way we'd once chased each other around this country, Ackerman writes. They discover many overlapping locations, but no overlapping dates, perhaps a relief they never directly confronted each other. Palestinian novelist Ilas Kiri's Gate of the Sun offers a similar perspective. Like Grossman's Aura, the narrator tells stories to his comatose mentor, hoping to keep him alive. Kuri sees writing as using your wounds to heal your wounds. The Arabic linguistic origin of word is wound. He individualizes each character through crucial life moments. I'm scared of history that has only one version. History has dozens of versions, and for it to ossify into one only leads to death. For both Kuri and Grossman, storytelling is an act of love and hope. With remarkable generosity, Kuri reminds us of his enemy's tragedy, insisting that having been a victim never justifies making victims of others. Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale contrasts nature's peaceful silence with oppression's eerie quiet. The mandatory veil in Iran isn't about faith, it's state control through uniformity. Atwood deliberately placed Gilead in America, showing totalitarianism can emerge anywhere. These systems appear gradually. Many ignore warning signs, especially when rulers initially target the marginalized. Resisting totalitarianism begins by refusing to normalize brutality. Under such regimes, the routine becomes extraordinary. As Offred observes, "Where I am is not a prison, but a privilege." Iranian women sensed this early, refusing mandatory veiling despite floggings and jail. Dehumanization creates an it where a person once stood. Yet complications arise. Offred's commander wants Scrabble and genuine kisses, making him human. "He was no longer a thing to me. It complicates." In the Testaments, Aunt Lydia serves Gilead outwardly while secretly plotting its destruction. Atwood refuses simple characterizations. Victims can be fallible, villains human. Totalitarian mindsets reject complication, yet Atwood reveals unavoidable inconsistencies. Guardians peeking at forbidden faces, commanders playing forbidden games. These contradictions suggest the system will crumble. Atwood calls Offred's narrative witness literature, recording and hiding her story, trusting future discovery. By telling her story, she creates her reader. I tell, therefore you are. James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time warned that without addressing America's racial wounds, the fire next time would consume the country, a prophecy eerily accurate. Baldwin's genius lies in articulating rage while maintaining compassion, refusing to demonize white Americans trapped in history they don't understand. He writes, "I do not know many Negroes who are eager to be accepted by white people, still less to be loved by them. They, the blacks, simply don't wish to be beaten over the head by the whites every instant of our brief passage on this planet." Consider Razia, a religious girl from a poor Iranian family who borrowed and stole books from houses her mother cleaned. She loved Tolstoy and Austen, but her passion was Henry James and his fiercely independent women. Years later, I learned Razia had been arrested during student demonstrations and executed. Before her death, she shared memories of our Henry James classes with her cellmate. Henry James didn't save Razia from execution, but when stripped of everything, we instinctively turn to humanity's achievements that honor dignity, freedom, and beauty. As Elias Corey told me, Razia saved Henry James. Iranian writer Moniro Ravanipour, constantly fleeing after her brother's execution, found salvation in writing. "I write so they can't kill me. I write to stay alive." Literature creates a portable home that can never be confiscated, a space where we remain fully human despite external constraints. Writers and readers share an inseparable bond. The freedom of one guarantees the others. Great writers witness truth and cannot remain silent, Once readers encounter their work, they too cannot stay quiet. As Baldwin said, the artist's war with society is a lover's war, to reveal the beloved to himself and, with that revelation, to make freedom real. Readers number in billions, their collective power immense. Every censored writer or banned book reminds us of our responsibility. Reading dangerously, engaging with challenging ideas, becomes an act of resistance against the tyranny of certainty. When faced with checkpoint guards or white nationalists, you've already won, because you carry a homeland they cannot confiscate, a freedom they cannot legislate away, and a truth they cannot burn. Readers of the world, unite. Your portable home awaits.